Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Chris Cameron, my co-host, Felicity Sinnell Reed, and our guest this week, novelist and historian, Erica Rummel. Erica, you've often written about a mixture of real and imagined characters in your historical novels, certainly real in the character of Carlo Gesualdo, a composer I know quite well. So what's the real story behind The Road to Gesualdo?
Carlo Gesualdo was a musical genius and is regarded today as one of the most innovative composers of the Renaissance. But by all accounts, he was mentally unbalanced and led a turbulent life. So when he caught his wife in the act of committing adultery, he killed both her and her lover. Now, this was legit. This was lawful in the 16th century. But his brutality shocked people, and so he became the subject of several lurid scandal sheets. 4 or 5 years later, he married the second time. He married Leonora, Princess of Ferrara. Now, their marriage was not harmonious. Now, her family urged Leonora to have the marriage annulled by the church, but she didn't go for that. She stuck with her husband. But on her initiative, the two women were prosecuted for witchcraft. And they were convicted and sentenced to prison in the dungeon of Gesualdo Castle. So how very convenient. You have your drug dealers right in the basement there.
It's good to have your own dungeon just to keep your witches.
All right, wonderful. Yeah, how convenient. So you will find that I fudged that last part and in my novel and gave it a happier ending.
That I'm glad to hear that anyway. The story is told through the eyes of Livia, who's Leonora's lady-in-waiting, and her friend. And she, too, has some romantic problems in the plot. Can you tell us about her? And is she the actual narrator of the story?
Well, she's not the narrator, but part one is told from Livia's perspective. And it deals with Leonora's problematic marriage and her loyalty to her husband, which leads to the discovery that Aurelia, a reputed witch, has poisoned him with drugs. Now, Livia, who supports her mistress in this precarious situation, also becomes a target for Aurelia's murderous plots. Now, part two, then, is told from the perspective of Livia's lover, Pietro, and it deals with the intrigues he encounters as a diplomat, which makes him realize that he had his priorities wrong when he followed his ambitions rather than his love for Livia. So this change in point of view gives me a chance to tell this story from the perspective of a male as well as a female protagonist.
And you must have done a ton of research for this novel. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did read quite a number of books about Carlo Gesualdo, but I also decided I needed to see his castle to get a better grip on the setting of my novel. But when I Googled Gesualdo, this is some years ago, I discovered that the castle was under renovation and closed to the public. So then I wrote to Alex Ross. He's the music critic for The New Yorker. In fact, it was Ross's article on Gesualdo that was my original inspiration. And so I asked for his help, and he put me in touch with a musicologist in Gesualdo. So when I arrived there, I was given this celebrity welcome. The town, it's actually a large village, put me up in the hotel. The mayor came and shook hands with me. The architect in charge of the renovations gave me a private tour of the castle. And the owner of the hotel insisted that I absolutely must go and visit his farm, which was an olive tree plantation. And right around the farmhouse, there were a few very old olive trees, he said 100 years old, and he told me to go and hug them, and they would give me happiness, wealth, and a long and healthy life. So I did go, and I hugged each of these trees, and hey, for all I know, they have protected me against COVID. So really, I must say that was the most enjoyable research that I've ever done for a historical novel.
I know that you write all sorts of stuff. You write fiction, biographies, you write academic works of nonfiction, and sometimes it seems like you're doing them all at the same time. Are there problems of doing that cross-genre writing at the same time?
The only problem that I could see is that fiction style is very different, of course, from academic style. And I find it sometimes difficult to make the switch, you know, to go back and forth. But otherwise, I would say it's good to have several projects.
You kind of have to shift gears, I guess, to move from a piece of fiction to an academic work. Yes, I can see that. Getting back to The Road to Gesualdo, I wonder if you could read us some more from it.
This is the scene in which Aurelia is before the court on charges of witchcraft. The vaulted chamber in which the inquisitorial trial was held was lit only by a set of tall candles and the slanted rays of the light coming through a solitary barred window. The walls were bare except for a large iron cross. The examiners entered in procession behind two servants bearing torches, casting their light on the gloomy room. The inquisitor, dressed in a red robe, took his seat at the center. When Aurelia was led in, there wasn't a man who could resist gaping at her. They were astonished by her beauty and moved by her melting eyes. Her head was crowned with thick hair of the darkest brown. She had a supple figure and moved with the indolent grace of a cat. Her style of dress was demure, but cut in a cunning fashion to reveal her tempting curves. At a nod from the inquisitor, the notary placed a Bible before her, and after she had been sworn in, the inquisitor rose and asked, "Have you, an unmarried woman, had relations with men?" "No, Your Honor." "I remind you that you are under oath and have sworn to speak the truth. Have you had relations with men?" "No," she repeated firmly. The inquisitor paused and gave her a probing look before he continued on a new tack. "Have you ever been in the company of the prince?" "I have, but not very often." "The witnesses say that you sell magic potions. Have you given potions to the prince?" "Never." "Have you received money or gifts from the prince?" She hesitated. "A necklace once." "Was this gift given in remuneration for a service you provided to the prince?" "No, the gift was freely given." "I remind you to speak the truth, Aurelia. If you're obstinate, we may have to apply torture. Have you had carnal relations with the prince?" "Never." Again, there was a ring of defiance in her voice. "Put the accused to the torture," the inquisitor said, and called in his servants. Aurelia cringed at the sight of the two burly men. "No," she screamed. "I beg your honor, don't put me to the torture." "Do you wish to change your answer?" he said. But she shook her head, and the servants took her arms roughly and marched her off between them, crying for mercy. The inquisitor turned to Fra Lippo. "Go with them and observe the procedure," he said to the Dominican. "Make sure that the accused is completely undressed and her orifices searched. Witches often conceal charms or amulets on their body that make them insensitive to pain. And report to us what the accused says under torture, and especially when she's moved to tears, for that is something to watch for. A witch has no tears." So Aurelia is put to torture, and the Dominican returns to report to the court. "She has confessed," he said. "She was stripped and thoroughly searched, but she had no talisman on her body." When Aurelia was brought back into the courtroom, held up by the two servants, she was a pitiful sight. Her dress was in disorder, her hair disheveled, her face racked with pain and smeared with tears. When the servants let go of her arms, she collapsed on the stone floor. The inquisitor ordered a stool to be brought and motioned the servants to help her up. She slumped on the stool, moaning. So in the end, the court acquits her of witchcraft, and there is a ceremony to reconcile her with the church in which she swears off the devil. When the rite was over, she asked, "And am I free to go now?" "You have saved your soul, Aurelia, and we rejoice with you on earth as the angels rejoice in heaven. This court dismisses you, but you will be handed over to the secular court to answer the other accusations brought against you, the intended murder of Livia Privera and of Leonora d'Este, whom you attempted to poison." When she heard what awaited her, she howled in desperation and fell to the floor like one dead. "Take her away," the inquisitor said to one of the guards. But as the man bent over her, she reared up, snatched the dagger from his belt, and plunged it into her heart.
Very, very vividly described. Many thanks to you, Erica, for coming in today and telling us about your new novel, The Road to Gesualdo. Where can listeners buy your books?
Well, I suggest first of all, there is the publisher would like you to order from him. So the publisher, DX Varos, V-A-R-O-S. But locally, you can, of course, go to Corbett's Let's Talk Books or to Lighthouse Books in Brighton or to Furby House in Port Hope.
Thanks for coming by and taking time to talk to us. To connect with us, please send comments, queries, or suggestions for who we might interview in future episodes to us at our website, wordonthehills.com, where all these programs are archived and available to listeners at any time. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you'll join us for another show next week on Northumberland 89.7, Truly Local Radio.